If I waited, maybe I could use them as stepping stones. Stop, think about the game. But it was too late. I wouldn't try it. Angelus watched me from the other side of the pool. No mortal can survive that water. You need the bridge to cross, and as you can see, it's been removed. A security precaution. He held his hand in front of him, twisting the air into a current I could feel all the way across the water. I had to brace myself to stay on my feet. You will not retrieve your page. You will die the same dishonorable death as your namesake, the death all mortals deserve. Why me? And why him? Why any of us? What did we ever do to you, Angelus? I shouted at him over the wind. You are inferior, born without the gifts of supernaturals, forcing us to stay in hiding while your cities and schools fill with children who will grow to do nothing more than occupy space. You've turned our world into our prison. The air picked up and he twisted his hand further. It's absurd, like building a city for rodents. I waited, picturing that stupid baseball game, Earl swinging, the crack of the bat, until the words formed and I spoke them. But you were born a mortal. What does that make you? His eyes widened, his face a mask of pure rage. What did you say? You heard me. I turned my mind to the vision I'd seen, forcing myself to remember the faces, the words. Xavier, when he was just a caster. Angelus, when he was just a man. The wind increased and I stumbled, the edge of my sneaker splashing at the edge of the pool of bodies. I braced myself, willing my feet not to slip. Angelus's face had turned even paler than before. You know nothing. Look what you sacrificed. To save what? A town full of pathetic mortals? I closed my eyes, letting the words find him. I know you were born a mortal. All those experiments can't change that. I know your secret. His eyes widened, hate raging across his face. I am not a mortal. I never was, and I never will be. I know your secret. The wind picked up, and rocks flew again through the air, harder this time. I tried to shield my face as they pelted my ribs, smashing against the wall behind me. A trail of blood ran down my cheek. I will tear you to shreds, wayward! I screamed over the din. You may have powers, Angelus, but deep down, you're still a mortal, just like me! You can't harness dark forces like Seraphine and Abraham, or travel like an incubus. You can't cross that water any more than I can. I am not mortal, he screamed. Nobody can. Liar! Prove it. There was a second, one terrible second, when Angelus and I stared across the water at each other. Then, without a word, Angelus flung himself into the air, lunging across the corpses in the pool, as if he couldn't contain himself a moment longer. That's how desperate he was to prove he was better than me. Better than a mortal. Better than anyone else who ever tried to walk on water. I had been right. The rotting corpses were packed so tight that he ran right over their bodies until they started to move. Arms reached for him, the hundreds of bloated hands rising up out of the water. This was not like the river I had crossed to get here. This river was alive. An arm slithered over his neck, weighing him down. No! I shuddered as his voice echoed against the walls. The corpses tore at his robe desperately, pulling him down into the abyss of loss and misery. The same souls he had tortured were drowning him. His eyes locked on mine. Help me! Why should I? But there was nothing I could do, even if I'd wanted to. I knew those corpses would drown me. I was mortal, just as Angelus was. At least part of him. Nobody walks on water, not where I come from. Nobody except the guy in the picture frame in Sunday school class. Too bad Angelus wasn't from Gatlin. He would have known that. His hands clawed at the surface of the water until there was nothing left but a sea of bodies again. The stench of death was everywhere. It was suffocating, and I tried to cover my mouth, but the distinct odor of rot and decay was too strong. I knew what I'd done. I wasn't innocent, not in Seraphine's death, and not in this one either. He was reading my mind, and I had pushed him to this, even if his hate and pride had propelled him into the pool. It was too late. A rotted arm slid around his neck, and within seconds he disappeared under the sea of bodies. It was a death I wouldn't have wished on anyone. Not even Angelus. Maybe just him. Within moments, the pool turned milky white again, though I knew what was lurking underneath. I shrugged. Wasn't much of a challenge after all. I had to find the bridge, or something I could use to cross. The splintering plank wasn't well hidden. I found it in an alcove only a few yards from where Angelus stood moments ago. The wood was dry and cracked, which wasn't reassuring, considering what I had just witnessed. But the book was so close. As I slid the plank over the surface of the water, I could practically feel Lena in my arms and hear Amma hollering at me. I couldn't think straight. All I knew was I had to get across that water and get back to them. Please, let me cross. All I want is to go home. With that thought, I took a breath, then a step, then another. I was 5 feet from the edge of the water now, maybe 6, halfway across. There was no turning back now. The bridge was surprisingly light, though it creaked and wobbled with my every step. Still, it had held up so far. I took a deep breath. 5 more feet. 4. I heard a crash like a wave behind me. The water began to thrash. I felt a shooting pain in my leg as it gave way beneath me. The old board snapped like a broken toothpick. Before I could scream, I lost my balance, falling into the deadly water. Only then, there wasn't any water. Or if there was, I wasn't in it. I was in the arms of the rising dead. Worse, I was face to face with the other Ethan Waite. He was as much a skeleton as he was a man, but I recognized him now. I tried to pull away, but he grabbed me around the neck with a bony hand. Water poured out of his mouth where his teeth should have been. I'd had nightmares less terrifying. I turned my head to keep corpse drool from my face. Could a mortal cast an ambulans mortus? Angelus pushed past the dead who crowded around me, pulling my arms and legs in every direction with such force I thought my limbs would rip right out of their sockets. From under the water, to wake the dead. He stood triumphantly on the land in front of the book, looking crazier than I'd thought even a crazy-looking keeper could. The challenge is over. Your soul is mine. I didn't answer. I couldn't speak. Instead, I found myself staring into Ethan Waite's empty eyes. Now, bring him to me. At Angelus's command, the corpses rose from the stinking water, pulling me with them up onto the shore. The other Ethan tossed me onto the dirt like I was weightless. As he did, a small black stone rolled out of my pocket. Angelus didn't notice. He was too busy staring at the book. but I saw it clear enough. The river's eye. I had forgotten to pay the river master. Of course, you couldn't just expect to cross the water any time you wanted, not around here, not without paying a price. I picked up the rock. Ethan Waite, the dead one, whipped his head toward me. The look he gave me, if that's what you'd call it, considering the guy barely had eyes, sent a shiver down my spine. I felt sorry for him, but I sure didn't want to be him. Between the two of us, we owed each other that much. "So long, Ethan," I said. With my last remaining bit of strength, I hurled the rock into the water. I heard it hit, making only the tiniest sound. You wouldn't have noticed it unless you were me, or one of the dead, because they disappeared a few seconds after the rock hit the water, about as quickly as it took a rock to sink all the way down to the bottom of a pool of bodies. I fell back on the tiny stretch of dry land, exhausted. For a second, I was too scared to move. Then I saw Angelus standing there, glued to the book, reading in the light of the flickering green and gold flames. I knew what I had to do, and I didn't have long to do it. I pulled myself to my feet. There it was. It was open on the pedestal, right in front of me. In front of Angelus, too. The Castor Chronicles. I reached for the book, and it burned my fingers. "Don't!" Angelus growled, grabbing my wrist. His eyes were shining, as if the book had some strange hold on him. He didn't even look up from the page. I'm not sure he could, because it was his page. I could almost read it from where I stood, 1,000 rewritten words, one crossed out over the next. I could see the quill, ink-stained at the tip, almost twitching in his fingers next to the book. So this was how he'd done it, how he'd forced the supernatural world to bend to his will. He controlled the story. Not just his, but all of ours. Angelus had changed everything. One person could do that, and one person could change it back. "Angelus?" He didn't answer. Staring into the book, he looked more like a zombie than the corpses did. So I didn't look. Instead, I closed my eyes and pulled on the page as hard and as fast as I could. "What are you doing?" Angelus sounded frantic, but I didn't open my eyes. "What have you done?" My hands were burning. The page wanted to rip free from me, but I wouldn't let go. I only held on tighter. Nothing was going to stop me now. It came off in my hands. The ripping sound reminded me of an incubus, and I half expected to see John Breed or Link appear next to me. I opened my eyes. No such luck. Angelus reached for the page, shoving me in one direction while pulling my arm in another. I grabbed a dripping candle from the pedestal stand and lit the bottom of the page on fire. It began to smoke and flame, and Angelus howled with rage. "Leave it! You don't know what you're doing! You could destroy everything!" He threw himself at me, punching and kicking, almost ripping my shirt off. His nails raked my skin again and again, but I didn't let go. I didn't let go when I felt the flames sear their way down to my fingers. I didn't let go when the ink-smeared page crumbled into ash. I didn't let go until Angelus himself crumbled into nothing, as if he was made of parchment. Finally, when the wind had blown every last trace of the Keeper and his page into oblivion, I found myself staring at my burnt, blackened hands. My turn. Ducking my head, I flipped through the delicate pages of parchment. I could see dates and names at the top, penned by different hands. I wondered which ones Xavier had written. If Obadiah had changed anyone else's page, I hoped he wasn't the one who changed Ethan Carter Waite's. I thought of my namesake and shuddered, fighting to keep the bile down. That could have been me. Halfway through the book, I found our pages. Ethan Carter's was right before mine, the two pages clearly written by different hands. I skimmed Ethan Carter's page until I reached the part of the story I already knew. It read like a script of the vision I had witnessed with Lena, the story of the night he died, and Genevieve used the Book of Moons to bring him back, the night that started it all. I stared at the edge where the page met the binding. I almost tore it out, but I knew it wouldn't have made a difference. It was too late for the other Ethan. I was the only one who still had a chance to change his fate. Finally, I turned the page to find I was staring at Obadiah's script. Ethan Lawson Waite. I didn't read my page. I couldn't risk it. I could already feel the pull of the book on my eyes, powerful enough to bind me to my page forever. I looked away. I already knew what happened in the end of this revision. Now I was changing it. I tore the page, the edges pulling away from the binding in a flash of electricity, stronger and brighter than lightning. I heard what sounded like thunder in the sky above me, but I kept tearing. This time, I kept the candles as far from the parchment as I could. I pulled until the words came loose, disappearing like they had been written in invisible ink. I looked down at the page again, and it was blank. I let it drop into the water around me, watching as it fell through the milky depths, vanishing into the endless shadow of the chasm. My page was gone, and in that second, I knew I was too. I stared at my chucks beneath me until they were gone, and I was gone, and it didn't matter anymore, because there was nothing beneath me now, and then no me. Chapter 35. A Crack in the Universe. The toes of my chucks hung over the white metal edge, a town sleeping hundreds of feet below me. The tiny houses and tiny cars looked like toys, and it was easy to imagine them dusted with glitter under the tree with the rest of my mother's Christmas town. But they weren't toys. I knew this view. You don't forget the last thing you see before you die. Trust me. I was standing on top of the Somerville Water Tower, veins of cracked white paint spreading out from under my sneakers. The curve of a black heart drawn in Sharpie caught my eye. Was it possible? Could I really be home? I didn't know until I saw her. The fronts of her black orthopedic shoes were lined up perfectly with my chucks. Amma was wearing her black Sunday dress with the tiny violets scattered all over it, and a wide-brimmed black hat. Her white gloves gripped the handles of her patent leather pocketbook. Our eyes met for a split second, and she smiled, relief spreading across her features in a way that was impossible to describe. It was almost peaceful, a word that I would never use to describe Amma. That's when I realized something was wrong, the kind of wrong you can't stop or change or fix. I reached for her at the exact same moment she stepped off the edge into the blue-black sky. Amma! I reached for her, the way I used to reach for Lena in my dreams when she was the one falling. But I couldn't catch Amma. And she didn't fall. The sky split open like the universe was tearing, or like someone had finally picked that hole in it. Amma turned her face toward it, tears running down her cheeks even as she smiled at me. The sky held her up, as though Amma was worthy of standing on it, until a hand reached out from the center of the tear and the blinking stars. It was a hand I recognized, the one that had offered me his crow so I could cross from one world to another. Now Uncle Abner was offering that hand to Amma. His face blurred in the darkness next to Sulla, Ivy, and Delilah, Amma's other family. Twyla's face smiled down at me, charms tied into her long braids. Amma's caster family was waiting for her. But I didn't care. I couldn't lose her. "Amma, don't leave me!" I shouted. Her lips didn't move, but I heard her voice, as sure as if she was standing next to me. "I could never leave you, Ethan Waite. I'll always be watching. Make me proud." My heart felt like it was collapsing in on itself, shattering into pieces so small I might never find them. I dropped to my knees and looked up into the heavens, screaming louder than I ever thought possible, "Why?" It was Amma who answered. She was farther away now, stepping into the sliver of sky that opened just for her. "A woman's only as good as her word." Another one of Amma's riddles. The last one. She touched her fingers to her lips and reached them out to me as the universe swallowed her up. Her words echoed across the sky as if she had spoken them aloud. "And everyone said I couldn't change the cards." The cards. She was talking about the spread that predicted my death so many months ago. The spread she had bargained with the Bacor to change. The one she swore she'd do anything to change. She'd done it, defied the universe and fate and everything she believed in. For me. Amma was trading her life for mine, protecting the Order by offering one life for another. That was the deal she had made with the Bacor. I understood now. I watched the sky knit itself back together, one stitch at a time. But it didn't look the same. I could still see the invisible seams where the world had torn itself in half to take her. And I would always know they were there, even if no one else could see them. Like torn edges of my heart. Chapter 36 Translation. As I sat on the cold metal in the darkness, part of me wondered if I imagined the whole thing. I knew I didn't. I could still see those stitches in the sky, no matter how dark it was. Still, I didn't move. If I left, it would be real. If I left, she would be gone. I don't know how long I sat there trying to make sense of everything, but the sun came up, and I was still sitting in the same spot. No matter how many times I tried to work it out, I kept getting stuck. I had this old Bible story in my head, playing over and over like a bad song from the radio. I'm probably getting it wrong, but I remember it like this. There was this city of people who were so righteous, they got picked right up off the earth and taken to heaven. Just like that, they didn't even die. They got to skip dying the way you pass go and head directly to jail if you pull the wrong card in Monopoly. Translated, that's the name for what happened to them. I remember because Link was in my Sunday school class, and he said teleported, then transported, and finally transportated. We were supposed to act real jealous about it, like those people were so lucky to get plucked up and taken into the lap of the Lord. Like it was a place or something. I remember coming home and asking my mom about it, because that's how creeped out I was. I don't remember what she said. But I decided right then and there that the goal wasn't to be good. It was to be just good enough. I didn't want to risk getting translated or even teleported. I wasn't looking to go live in the lap of the Lord. I was more excited about Little League. But it seemed like that's what happened to Amma. She was lapped right up, transported, transportated. All of it. Did the universe, or the Lord and his lap, or the greats, expect me to feel happy about it? I had just been through hell to get back to the regular world of Gatlin, back to Amma and Lena and Link and Marion. How long did we have together? Was I supposed to be okay with that? 1 minute she was there, and then it was over. Now the sky was the sky again, flat and blue and calm, as if it really was just painted plaster, like my bedroom ceiling. Even if someone I loved was trapped somewhere behind it. That's how I felt now, trapped on the wrong side of the sky. Alone on the top of the Somerville Water Tower, looking out over the world I had known my entire life. A world of dirt roads and paved routes, of gas stations and grocery stores and strip malls, and everything was the same, and nothing was the same. I wasn't the same. I guess that's the thing about a hero's journey. You might not start out a hero, and you might not even come back that way, but you change, which is the same as everything changing. The journey changes you, whether or not you know it, and whether or not you want it to. I had changed. I had come back from the dead, and Amma was gone, even if she was one of the greats now. You couldn't get more changed than that. I heard a clanging on the ladder beneath me, and I knew who it was before I felt her curling around my heart. The warmth exploded across me, across the water tower, across Somerville. The sky was striped with gold and red, as if the sunrise was reversing itself, lighting up the sky all over again. There was only one person who could do that to a sky or my heart. "Ethan, is that you?" I smiled even as my eyes turned wet and blurry. "It's me, El. I'm right here. Everything's going to be okay now." I reached my hand down and wrapped it around hers, pulling her up onto the platform at the top of the water tower. She slid into my arms, falling into sobs that beat against my chest. I don't know which one of us was crying harder. I'm not even sure we remembered to kiss. What we had went so much deeper than a kiss. When we were together, she turned me completely inside out. It didn't matter if we were dead or alive, we could never be kept apart. There were some things more powerful than worlds or universes. She was my world, as much as I was hers. What we had, we knew. The poems were all wrong. It's a bang, a really big bang, not a whimper. And sometimes, gold can stay. Anybody who's ever been in love can tell you that. Chapter 37. What the Words Never Say. Amma Trudeau has been declared legally dead following her disappearance from Waite's Landing, the home of Mitchell and Ethan Waite on Cotton Bend in central Gatlin. I stopped reading out loud. I was sitting at her kitchen table, where her one-eyed menace waited sadly in the mason jar on her counter, and it didn't seem possible that I was reading Amma's obituary, not when I could still smell the red hots and the pencil lead. "Keep reading." Aunt Grace was leaning over my shoulder, trying to read the print that her bifocals were 10 strengths too weak to read. Aunt Mercy was sitting in her wheelchair on the other side of the table next to my dad. "They best say something about Amma's pie, or the good Lord as my witness, I'll go down there to the stars and bars and give them a piece of my mind." Aunt Mercy still thought our town newspaper was named after the Confederate flag. It's the Stars and Stripes, my father corrected gently, and I'm sure they worked hard to assure Amma is remembered for all her talents. Aunt Grace sniffed. Folks round here don't know a lick about talent. Prudence Jane's singing was looked over by the choir for years. Aunt Mercy crossed her arms. She had the voice of an angel if I ever heard one. I was surprised Aunt Mercy could hear anything without her hearing aid. She was still carrying on when Lena began to kelt with me. Ethan, are you okay? I'm okay, Elle. You don't sound okay. I'm dealing. Hold on, I'm coming. Amma's face stared out at me from the newspaper, printed in black and white, wearing her best Sunday dress, the one with the white collar. I wondered if someone had taken that photo at my mom's funeral or Aunt Prue's. It could have been Macon's. There had been so many. I laid the paper down on the scarred wood. I hated that obituary. Someone from the paper must have written it, not someone who knew Amma. They'd gotten everything wrong. I guess I had a new reason to hate the Stars and Stripes as much as Aunt Grace did. I closed my eyes, listening to the sisters fuss about everything from Amma's obituary to the fact that Thelma couldn't make grits the right way. I knew it was their way of paying their respects to the woman who had raised my dad and me. The woman who had made them pitcher after pitcher of sweet tea and made sure they didn't leave the house with their skirts hitched up in their pantyhose when they left for church. After a while, I couldn't hear them at all, just the quiet sound of weights landing, mourning too. The floorboards creaked, but this time I knew it wasn't Amma in the next room. None of her pots were banging, no cleavers were attacking the cutting board, no warm food would be coming my way. Not unless my dad and I taught ourselves how to cook. There were no casseroles piled up on our porch either, not this time. There wasn't a soul in Gatlin who would have dared bring their sorry excuse for a pot roast to mark Miss Amma Trudeau's passing, and if they did, we wouldn't have eaten it. Not that anyone around here really believed she was gone. At least, that's what they said. She'll come back, Ethan. Remember the way she just showed up without saying a word the day you were born? It was true. Amma had raised my father and moved out to Waiters Creek with her family. But as the story goes, the day my parents brought me home from the hospital, she showed up with her quilting bag and moved back in. Now Amma was gone, and she wasn't coming back. More than anyone, I knew how that worked. I looked at the worn spot on the floorboards over by the stove in front of the oven door. I miss her, Elle. I miss her, too. I miss both of them. I know. I heard Thelma walk into the room, a hunk of tobacco tucked under her lip. All right, girls, I think y'all have had enough excitement for one morning. Let's go on in the other room and see what we can win on The Price is Right. Thelma winked at me and wheeled Aunt Mercy out of the room. Aunt Grace was right behind them with Harlan James at her feet. I hope they're giving away one of those ice boxes that makes water all on its own. My dad reached for the newspaper and started reading where I left off. Memorial services will be held at the chapel at Waiters Creek. My mind flashed on Amma and Macon standing face to face in the middle of the foggy swamp on the wrong side of midnight. Ah, hell. I tried to tell anyone who would listen, Amma doesn't want a service. He sighed. Nope. She's fussing around somewhere right now, saying, I don't see why you're wasting good time mourning me. Sure as my sweet Redeemer, I'm not wasting my time mourning you. I smiled. He cocked his head to the left, just like Amma did when she was on the rampage. TOMFOOLERY. 10 down, as in, this whole thing's nothing but hodgepodge and nonsense, Mitchell Waite. This time I laughed, because my dad was right. I could hear her saying it. She hated being the center of attention, especially when it involved the infamous Gatlin Funerary Pity Parade. My dad read the next paragraph. Miss Amma Trudeau was born in unincorporated Gatlin County, South Carolina, the 6th of 7 children born to the late Trudeau family. The 6th of 7 children? Had Amma ever mentioned her sisters and brothers? I only remembered her talking about the greats. He skimmed the length of the obituary. By some count, her career as a baker of local renown spanned at least 5 decades and as many county fairs. He shook his head again. But no mention of her Carolina gold? Good Lord! I hope Amma's not reading this from some cloud up on high. She'll be sending lightning bolts down, left and right. She's not, I thought. Amma doesn't care what they say about her now, not the folks in Gatlin. She's sitting on a porch somewhere with the greats. He kept going. Miss Amma leaves behind her extended family, a host of cousins, and a circle of close family friends. He folded up the paper and tossed it back onto the table. Where's the part where Miss Amma leaves behind 2 of the sorriest, hungriest, saddest boys ever to inhabit Waite's Landing? He tapped his fingers restlessly on the wood tabletop between us. I didn't know what to say at first. Dad? Yeah? We're going to be okay, you know? It was true. That's what she'd been doing all this time, if you thought about it, getting us ready for a time when she wouldn't be there to get us ready for all the times after that. For now. My dad must have understood, because he let his hand fall heavily on my shoulder. Yes, sir, don't I know it. I didn't say anything else. We sat there together, staring out the kitchen window. Anything else would be downright disrespectful. His voice sounded wobbly, and I knew he was crying. She raised us pretty well, Ethan. She sure did. I fought back the tears myself, out of respect, I guess, like my dad said. This was how it had to be now. This was real. It hurt. It almost killed me. But it was real, the same way losing my mom was real. I had to accept it. Maybe this was the way the universe was meant to unravel, at least this part of it. The right thing and the easy thing are never the same. Amma had taught me that better than anyone. Maybe she and Lila Jane are taking care of each other now. Maybe they're sitting together, talking over fried tomatoes and sweet tea. My dad laughed, even though he was crying. He had no idea how close to the truth he was, and I didn't tell him. Cherries, that was all I said. What? My dad looked at me funny. Mom likes cherries, straight out of the colander, remember? I turned my head his way, but I'm not sure Aunt Prue is letting either one of them get a word in edgewise. He nodded and stretched out his hand until it brushed against my arm. Your mom doesn't care. She just wants to be left in peace with her books for a while, don't you think? At least until we get there. At least, I said, though I couldn't look at him now. My heart was pulled so many different ways at once. I didn't know what I was feeling. Part of me wished I could tell him that I'd seen my mom, that she was okay. We sat like that, not moving or talking, until I felt my heart start to pound. Elle, is that you? Come out, Ethan. I'm waiting. I heard the music before I saw the beater roll into view through the window panes. I stood up and nodded at my dad. I'm going up to Lena's for a while. You take all the time you need. Thanks, Dad. As I turned to leave the kitchen, I caught one last sight of my dad sitting alone at the table with the newspaper. I couldn't do it. I couldn't leave him like that. I reached back for the paper. I don't know why I took it. Maybe I just wanted to keep her with me a little while longer. Maybe I didn't want my dad to sit alone with all those feelings, wrapped in a stupid paper with a bad crossword puzzle and a worse obituary. Then it came to me. I pulled open Amma's drawer and grabbed a number two pencil. I held it up to show my dad. He grinned, started out sharp, and then she sharpened it. It's what she would have wanted, one last time. He leaned back in his chair until he could reach the drawer and tossed me a box of Red Hots. One last time. I gave him a hug. I love you, Dad. Then I swept my hand across the length of the kitchen windows, sending salt spraying all over the kitchen floor. It's time to let the ghosts in. I only made it halfway down the porch steps before Lena found me. She jumped up into my arms, circling her skinny legs around mine. She clung to me, and I held on to her like neither one of us was ever letting go. There was electricity, plenty of electricity, but as her lips found mine, there was nothing but sweetness and peace, kind of like coming home, when a home's still a shelter and not the storm itself. Everything was different between us. There was nothing keeping us apart anymore. I didn't know if it was because of the new order or because I journeyed to the end of the other world and back. Either way, I could hold Lena's hand without burning a hole in my palm. Her touch was warm, her fingers were soft, her kiss was just a kiss now, a kiss that was every bit as big and every bit as small as a kiss can be. It wasn't an electrical storm or a fire. Nothing exploded or burned or even short-circuited. Lena belonged to me, the same way I belonged to her. And now, we could be together. The beater honked, and we broke off kissing.
Any day now, Link stuck his head out the window. I'm getting gray hairs sitting here watching you kids.
I grinned at him, but I couldn't pull myself away from her. I love you, Lena Duquesne. I always have, and I always will. The words were as true today as the first time I'd said them on her 16th moon. And I love you, Ethan Waite. I've loved you since the first day we met. Or before. Lena looked straight in my eyes, smiling. Way before. I smiled back, deep into hers. But I have something to tell you, she leaned closer, something you should probably know about the girl you love. My stomach flipped a little. What is it? My name. You're not serious. I knew casters learned their real names after they were claimed, but Lena was never willing to tell me hers, no matter how many times I asked. I figured it was hers to tell when she felt the time was right, which, I guess, was now. Do you still want to know? She grinned because she already knew the answer. I nodded. It's Josephine Duquesne. Josephine, daughter of Seraphine. The last word was a whisper, but I heard it, as if she had shouted it from the rooftops. I squeezed her hand. Her name, the last missing piece of her family puzzle, and the one thing you couldn't find on any family tree. I hadn't told Lena about her mother yet. Part of me wanted to believe that Seraphine had given up her soul so I could be with Lena again, that her sacrifice was about more than just revenge. Someday I would tell Lena what her mother did for me. Lena deserved to know. Seraphine wasn't all bad. The beater honked again,
Come on, lovebirds. We gotta get to the Dairy Queen. Everyone's waiting.
I grabbed Lena's other hand and pulled her down the front lawn to the beater. We have to make a quick stop on the way.
Is this gonna involve any dark casters? Do I need the shears?
We're just going to the library. Link leaned his forehead against the steering wheel.
I haven't renewed my library card since I was 10. I think I'd have better odds with dark casters.
I stood in front of the car door and looked at Lena. The back door opened by itself, and we both climbed in.
Aw, man, now I'm your cab driver? You casters and mortals have a really screwed up way of showing your appreciation to a guy.
Link turned up the music as if he didn't want to hear whatever I had to say.
I appreciate you. I smacked his head from behind, good and hard.
He didn't even seem to feel it. I was talking to Link, but I was looking at Lena. I couldn't stop looking at her. She was more beautiful than I remembered, more beautiful and more real. I curled a strand of her hair through my fingers, and she leaned her cheek against my hand. We were together. It was hard to think or see or even talk about anything else. Then I felt bad for feeling so good when I was still carrying the stars and stripes in my back pocket.
Wait, check it out, Link paused. That's exactly what I needed to finish my new lyrics. Candy girl, hurts so sweet, she'll make you wanna hurl.
Lena put her head on my shoulder. Did I mention that my cousin's back in town?
Of course she is, I smiled.
Link winked at me in the rearview mirror. I smacked him in the head again as the car pulled down the street.
I think you're gonna be a rock star, I said. I gotta get back to working on my demo track, you know? Cause as soon as we graduate, I'm heading straight to New York, the big time.
Link was so full of crap, he could pass for a toilet. Just like the old days. Just like it was supposed to be. It was all the proof I needed. I was really home. Chapter 38. 11 Across.
You kids go on in, Link said, turning up the latest Holy Rollers demo. I'm gonna wait here. I get enough of books at school.
Lena and I climbed out of the beater and stood in front of the Gatlin County Library. The repairs were further along than I remembered. All the major construction was finished on the outside, and the fine ladies of the DAR had already started planting saplings near the door. The inside of the building was less finished. Plastic sheets hung across one side, and I could see tools and sawhorses on the other. But Aunt Marion had already set up this particular area, which didn't surprise me at all. She would rather have half a library than no library any day.
Aunt Marion?
My voice echoed more than usual, and within seconds she appeared at the end of the aisle in her stocking feet. I could see the tears in her eyes as she rushed in for a hug. I still can't believe it. She hugged me tighter.
Trust me, I know.
I heard the sound of dress shoes against the uncarpeted concrete.
Mr. Waite, it is a pleasure to see you, son.
Macon had a huge smile plastered across his face. It was the same one he seemed to have every time he saw me now, and it was starting to creep me out a little. He gave Lena a squeeze and made his way over to me. I held out my hand to shake his, but he swung his arm around my neck instead.
It's good to see you too, sir. We kinda wanted to talk to you and Aunt Marion.
She raised an eyebrow.
Oh?
Lena was twisting her charm necklace, waiting for me to explain. I guess she didn't want to break the news to her uncle that we could make out all we wanted now without putting my life in danger. So I did the honors. And as intrigued as Macon seemed, I was pretty sure he liked it better when kissing Lena posed the threat of electric shock. Marion turned to Macon at a loss.
Remarkable. What do you think it means?
He was pacing in front of the stacks.
I'm not entirely sure.
Whatever it is, do you think it will affect other casters and mortals? Lena was hoping this was some kind of change in the order of things, maybe a cosmic bonus after everything I'd been through.
That's doubtful, but we will certainly look into it.
He glanced at Marion. She nodded. Of course. Lena tried to hide her disappointment, but her uncle knew her too well.
Even if this isn't affecting other casters and mortals, it is affecting the two of you. Change has to start somewhere, even in the supernatural world.
I heard a creak, and the front door slammed.
Dr. Ashcroft?
I looked at Lena. I would have known that voice anywhere. Apparently, Macon recognized it too, because he ducked behind the stacks with Lena and me.
Hello, Martha,
Marion gave Mrs. Lincoln her friendliest librarian voice.
Was that Wesley's car I saw out front? Is he in here?
I'm sorry, he's not. Link was probably scrunched down on the floor of the beater, hiding from his mother.
Is there anything else I can do for you today?
Marion asked politely.
What you can do, Mrs. Lincoln fussed, is try to read this book of witchcraft and explain to me how we can allow our children to check this out of the public library.
I didn't have to look to know what series she was referring to, but I just couldn't help myself. I poked my head around the corner to see Link's mom waving a copy of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince in the air. I couldn't stop myself from smiling. It was good to know some things in Gatlin would never change. I didn't take the Stars and Stripes out during lunch. They say that when someone you love dies, you can't eat. But today, I had a cheeseburger with extra pickles, a double order of fries, a raspberry Oreo shake, and a banana split with hot fudge, caramel, and extra whip. I felt like I hadn't eaten in weeks. I guess I hadn't actually eaten anything in the other world, and my body seemed to know it. As Lena and I ate, Link and Ridley were joking around together, which sounded more like fighting to anyone who didn't know better. Ridley shook her head.
Seriously, the beater? Didn't we go over this on the way here?
I wasn't listening! I only pay attention to about 10% of what you say.
He glanced at her over his shoulder.
I'm 90% too busy looking at you saying it.
Yeah, well, maybe I'm 100% too busy looking the other way.
She acted annoyed, but I knew Ridley better than that. Link only grinned.
And they say you don't use math in real life.
Ridley unwrapped a red lollipop and made a show of it, like always.
If you think I'm going to New York with you in that rust bucket, you're crazier than I thought, Hot Rod.
Link nuzzled her neck and Rid swatted him.
Come on, babe, it was awesome last time, and this time we won't have to sleep in the beater.
Lena raised an eyebrow at her cousin.
You slept in a car?
Rid tossed her blonde and pink hair.
I couldn't leave Shrinky Dink alone. It's not like he was a hybrid back then.
Link wiped his greasy hands on his Iron Maiden t-shirt.
You know you love me, Rid. Admit it!
Ridley pretended to scoot away from him, but she barely moved an inch.
I'm a siren, in case you've forgotten. I don't love anything.
Link kissed her on the cheek.
Except me! You got room for two more?
John was balancing a tray of freezes and French fries in one hand, his other hand locked around Liv's. Lena smiled at Liv and moved over.
Always.
There was a time when I couldn't get the two of them to stand in the same room, but that felt like a lifetime ago. Technically, for me, I guess it was. Liv tucked herself under John's arm. She was wearing her periodic table shirt and her trademark blonde braids.
I hope you don't think we're sharing those.
She slid the paper boat full of chili fries in front of her.
I would never get between you and your fries, Olivia. John leaned over and gave her a quick kiss.
Smart boy.
Liv looked happy. Not make the best of it happy, but the real kind of happy. And I was happy for both of them. Charlotte Chase called out from behind the counter. Looked like her summer job had turned into a year-round after-school job.
Anybody want a slice of pecan pie, fresh out of the oven?
She held up the sad-looking boxed pie. It wasn't fresh out of anybody's oven, not even Sarah Lee's.
No thanks, Lena said.
Link was still staring at the pie.
Bet it's not good enough to be Amma's worst pecan pie.
He missed Amma, too. I could tell. She had always been on him about one thing or another. But she loved Link, and he knew it. Amma let him get away with things I never could, which reminded me of something. Link, what did you do in my basement when you were 9 years old? To this day, Link had never told me what Amma had on him. I had always wanted to know, but it was the one secret I'd never been able to get out of him. Link squirmed in his seat.
Come on, man. Some things are private.
Ridley looked at him suspiciously.
Is that when you got into the schnapps and puked everywhere?
He shook his head.
Nah, that was someone else's basement.
He shrugged.
Hey, there's a whole lot of basements around here.
We were all staring at him.
Fine. He ran his hand over his spiky hair nervously. She caught me,
he hesitated.
She caught me dressed up.
Dressed up? I didn't even want to think about what that meant. Link rubbed his face, embarrassed.
It was awful, dude. And if my mom ever found out, she'd kill you for saying it and me for doing it.
What were you wearing? Lena asked. A dress? High heels? He shook his head. His face was turning red with shame.
Worse.
Ridley whacked him on the arm, looking pretty nervous herself.
Spill! What the hell did you have on?
Link hung his head.
A Union soldier's uniform. I stole it from Jimmy Weeks' garage.
I burst out laughing, and within seconds, so did Link. No one else at the table understood the sin in a Southern boy with a father who led the Confederate cavalry in the reenactment of the Battle of Honey Hill, and a mother who was a proud member of the Sisters of the Confederacy, trying on a Civil War uniform for the opposing side.
You had to be from Gatlin.
It was one of those unspoken truths, like you don't make a pie for the waits because it won't be better than Amma's. You don't sit in front of Sissy Honeycutt in church because she talks the whole time right along with the preacher. And you don't choose the paint color for your house without consulting Mrs. Lincoln. Not unless your name happens to be Lila Evers Waite. Gatlin was like that. It was family, all of it and all of them, the good parts and the bad. Mrs. Asher even told Mrs. Snow to tell Mrs. Lincoln to tell Link to tell me that she was glad to have me home from Aunt Caroline's in one piece. I told Link to thank her, and I meant it. Maybe Mrs. Lincoln would even make me some of her famous brownies again one day. If she did, I bet I would clean the plate. When Link dropped us off, Lena and I headed straight for Greenbrier. It was our place, and no matter how many terrible things happened here, it would always be the place where we found the locket, where I saw Lena move the clouds for the first time, even if I didn't realize it, where we'd practically taught ourselves Latin trying to translate from the Book of Moons. The secret garden at Greenbrier held our secrets from the beginning. And in a way, we were beginning again. Lena gave me a funny look when I finally unrolled the paper I had been carrying around all afternoon. What's that? She closed her spiral notebook, the one she spent all her time writing in, like she couldn't get everything on the page fast enough. The crossword puzzle. We lay on our stomachs in the grass, curled up against each other in our old spot by the tree near the lemon groves, near the hearthstone. True to its name, Greenbrier was the greenest I'd ever seen it. Not a lubber or a bunch of dead brown grass in sight. Gatlin really was back to the best version of its old self.
We did this, El. We didn't know how powerful we were.
She leaned her head on my shoulder.
We do now.
I didn't know how long it would last, but I swore to myself that I wouldn't take it for granted ever again. Not 1 minute of what we had.
I thought we could do it, you know, for Amma. The crossword?
I nodded, and she laughed.
You know, I never even looked at those crossword puzzles, not once. Not until you were gone and started using them to talk to me.
Pretty clever, right? I nudged her. Better than you trying to write songs. Though your puzzles weren't that great either. She smiled, biting her lower lip. I couldn't resist kissing it over and over and over until she finally pulled away laughing. Okay, they were much better. She touched her forehead to mine. I smiled. Admit it, El. You loved my crosswords.
Are you kidding? Of course I did. You came back to me every time I looked at those stupid puzzles.
I was desperate. We unrolled the paper between us, and I got out the number 2 pencil. I should have known what we'd see. Amma had left me a message, like the ones I left for Lena. 2 across, as in, to be or not to. B-E. 4 down, as in, the opposite of evil. G-O-O-D. 5 down, as in, the victim of a sledding injury from an Edith Wharton novel. E-T-H-A-N. 10 across, as in, an expression of joy. H-A-L-L-E-L-U-J-A-H. I crumpled up the paper and pulled Lena toward me. Amma was home. Amma was with me, and Amma was gone. I pretty much wept until the sun fell out of the sky and the meadow around me was as dark and as light as I felt.
Chapter 39. A Hymn for Amma. Order is not orderly, no more than things are things. Hallelujah. No sense to be made of water towers or Christmas towns when you can't tell up from down. Hallelujah. Graves are always grave, from inside or out, and love breaks what can't be broken. Hallelujah. One I loved, one I loved, I lost. Now she is strong, though she is gone. Found and paid her way, she flew away. Hallelujah. Light the dark, sing the greats. A new day. Hallelujah. Epilogue. After. That night, I lay in my ancient mahogany bed in my room, like generations of weights before me. Books beneath me, broken cell phone next to me, old iPod hanging around my neck. Even my road map was back on the wall again. Lena had taped it up herself. It didn't matter how comfortable everything was. I couldn't sleep. That's how much thinking I had to do. At least, remembering. When I was little, my grandfather died. I loved my grandfather for 1,000 reasons I couldn't tell you and 1,000 stories I could barely remember. After it happened, I hid out back, up in the tree that grew halfway out of our fence, where the neighbors used to throw green peaches at my friends and me, and where we used to throw them at the neighbors. I couldn't stop crying, no matter how hard I jammed my fists into my eyes. I guess I never realized people could die before. First, my dad came outside and tried to talk me down out of that stupid tree. Then my mom tried. Nothing they said could make me feel any better. I asked if my grandpa was in heaven, like they said in Sunday school. My mom said she wasn't sure. It was the historian in her. She said no one really knew what happened when we died. Maybe we became butterflies. Maybe we became people all over again. Maybe we just died and nothing happened. I only cried harder. A historian isn't really what you're looking for in that kind of situation. That's when I told her I didn't want Poppy to die. But more than that, I didn't want her to die. And even more than that, I didn't want to die either. Then she broke down. It was her dad. I came down from the tree on my own afterward, and we cried together. She pulled me into her arms right there on the back steps of Waits Landing and said I wouldn't die. I wouldn't. She promised. I wasn't going to die, and neither would she. After that, the only thing I remember was going inside and eating 3 pieces of raspberry cherry pie, the kind with the crisscross sugar crust. Someone had to die before Amma would make that pie. Eventually, I grew up and grew older and stopped looking for my mom's lap every time I felt like crying. I even stopped going in that old tree. But it was years before I realized my mom had lied to me. It wasn't until she left me that I even remembered what she'd said. I don't know what I'm trying to say. I don't know what any of this is really about. Why we bother. Why we're here. Why we love. I had a family, and they were everything to me, and I didn't even know it when I had them. I had a girl, and she was everything to me, and I knew it every second I had her. I lost them all, everything a guy could ever want. I found my way home again, but don't be fooled. Nothing's the same as before. I'm not sure I'd want it to be. Either way, I'm still one of the luckiest guys around. I'm not a church kind of person, not when it comes to praying. To be honest, for me, it never gets much past hoping. But I know this, and I want to say it. And I really hope someone will listen. There is a point. I don't know what it is, but everything I've had, and everything I've lost, and everything I felt, it meant something. Maybe there isn't a meaning to life. Maybe there's only a meaning to living. That's what I've learned. That's what I'm going to be doing from now on. Living and loving, sappy as it sounds. Lena Duquesne, her name rhymes with rain. I'm not falling anymore. That's what Elle says, and she's right. I guess you could say I'm flying. We both are. And I'm pretty sure somewhere up there in the real blue sky and Carpenter B greatness, Amma's flying too. We all are, depending on how you look at it, flying or falling. It's up to us. Because the sky isn't really made of blue paint, and there aren't just 2 kinds of people in this world, the stupid and the stuck. We only think there are. Don't waste your time with either, with anything. It's not worth it. You can ask my mom if it's the right kind of starry night. The kind with 2 Castor moons and a northern and a southern star. At least, I know I can. I get up in the night and make my way across the creaking floorboards. They feel astonishingly real, and there isn't a moment I think I'm dreaming. In the kitchen, I take an armful of spotless glasses out of the cupboard that hangs over the counter. One by one, I set them on the table in a row, empty except for moonlight. The refrigerator light is so bright it surprises me. On the bottom shelf, tucked behind a rotting head of unchopped cabbage, I find it. Chocolate milk, just as I suspected. I might not have wanted it anymore, and I might not have been here to drink it, but I knew there was no way Amma had stopped buying it. I rip open the cardboard and fold out the spout, something I could do in my sleep, which is practically the state I'm in. I couldn't make Uncle Abner a pie if my life depended on it, and I don't even know where Amma keeps the recipe for Tunnel of Fudge. But this I know. One by one, I fill the glasses. One for Aunt Prue, who saw everything without blinking. One for Twyla, who gave up everything without hesitating. One for my mom, who let me go not once, but twice. One for Amma, who took her place with the greats so I could take mine in Gatlin again. A glass of chocolate milk doesn't seem like enough, but it isn't really the milk, and we all know that. All of us here, anyway. Because the moonlight shimmers in the empty wooden chairs around me, and I know, as always, that I am not alone. I'm never alone. I push the last glass through the patch of moonlight across the scarred kitchen table. The light flutters like the twinkling of a shear's eye. Drink up, I say, but it's not what I mean, especially not to Amma and my mom. I love you, and I always will. I need you, and I keep you with me. The good and the bad, the sugar and the salt, the kicks and the kisses, what's come before and what will come after, you and me. We are all mixed up in this together, under one warm pie crust. Everything about me remembers everything about you. Then I take a fifth glass down from the shelf, the last of our clean glasses. I fill it to the brim with milk, so close that I have to slurp the top to keep it from overflowing. Lena laughs at the way I always fill my cup as full as it can go. I feel her smiling in her sleep. I raise my glass to the moon and drink it myself. Life has never tasted sweeter. Here endeth the Castor Chronicles. Fabula peracta est, scripta aeterna manent. A seer's moons, a siren's tears, 19 mortal wayward fears, incubus graves and Castor rivers, the final page, the end delivers. Acknowledgements. We've loved every minute of this, every character, every chapter, every page. More than anything, all we need to acknowledge now is the one person who made it all happen. You. Our favorite Castor listeners. Thank you for everything, for all of it. It's been a wild ride. We hope you'll keep reading and keep believing in true love. Things hidden in plain sight, the world between the cracks, and more than anything, yourself. We know we will. Love always, and we do mean that. Cammy and Margie. Special thanks to our editor, Julie Scheina. Our Latin translator, Dr. Sarah Lindheim. Our creative director, Dave Kaplan. Our copy editor, Barbara Bukowski. Our publicity manager, Jessica Bromberg. Our marketing manager, Lisa Ickowitz. And the entire Beautiful Creatures Novels team at Little Brown Books for Young Readers.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Beautiful Redemption. Written by Cami Garcia and Margaret Stoll. Read by Kevin T. Collins and Christine Vam. Produced by Michelle McGonigal. Directed by Graham Malcolm and Michelle McGonigal. Recorded by Tommy Herron. Edited by Chris Howerton. Sound design by Michelle McGonigal. Mixed and mastered by Michelle McGonigal. Original music composed and performed by Michelle McGonigal. Beautiful Redemption is also available in print and as an ebook from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2012 by Cami Garcia and Margaret Stoll. Audio production copyright and published 2012 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook, without the permission of the publisher, is unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.